Well, we're going to continue with these incredible stories with Dr. Harley Rothbart, editor of Miracles We Have Seen. America's leading physicians share stories they can't forget. And we'll take your stories, too. Maybe you've come across something like this in your life. And welcome back to Coast, Dr. Harley Rothbart with us, of course, in this book, Miracles We Have Seen. And they are great miracles. Doctor, how many near-death experiences stories came in that way?
I haven't counted, but I would say that we probably have a dozen or more of stories of patients who were presumed dead, may have in fact died. There may be in fact two dozen such stories where resuscitations, CPR, in the most competent, efficient intensive care units in the country were carried on apparently to no avail. In one case, nearly 2 hours of resuscitation of a little boy, and all, again, hope gone, and then a recovery, a remarkable, unimaginable, unexplainable recovery. In some cases, after CPR had stopped, and the physicians had told the family to come in and say goodbye, seemingly in response to shrieking prayer by family members, a patient suddenly restored their heartbeat after the CPR has stopped. So I would say that if you add all of the stories of patients who recovered from coma, patients who had remarkable resuscitative efforts, that seemed to fail and then somehow succeeded, and patients who were near death from terminal diseases, I would say that there were probably two dozen or more near-death experiences from the patient's perspective that occurred in this book. And they're stunning. I mean, we read about near-death experiences, and we hear from patients about the, you know, the visual or other aura that they experience. But here we're seeing this occur through the eyes of the physician, the expert, who is seeing something that he or she can't explain.
No, it's just, it does boggle the mind, doesn't it?
It does, and I'll tell you, there are some stories that, pardon me, that are not near-death experiences that boggle the mind, too. There is the young woman who came in to see her OBGYN because her pregnancy test was positive in her early 20s, but she was having abdominal pain. And they did the ultrasound and found that the pregnancy was not where it was supposed to be in the uterus, but it was in the right fallopian tube.
Ectopic, right?
An ectopic pregnancy, precisely, that leads the tube that leads from the ovary to the uterus. Women have two fallopian tubes, one from the right ovary and one from the left ovary. That's how the egg makes its way to the uterus. But sometimes the egg becomes fertilized in the tube, and that is a non-viable pregnancy and can, in fact, be a very dangerous pregnancy. So this woman had a ruptured right fallopian tube that had to be removed to save her life. But thankfully, the doctor explained to the woman that she had an intact left fallopian tube, so would be able to get pregnant again. But unfortunately, a year later, the woman came in with another pregnancy in the tube, this time, of course, the left tube, the only remaining tube. The doctor was able to remove the pregnancy from the tube, again, preventing a rupture of the tube and potentially a life-threatening event to this woman, and was able to repair, to the best of her ability, the OB doctor was, this left fallopian tube, sent the woman home with some hope that she could still become pregnant with the remaining, now repaired, left fallopian tube. But another year passed, and the woman came in again with now a tubal pregnancy in the repaired left tube, and this time it had ruptured and had to be removed. And so everyone was devastated, this young woman terribly disappointed that she could not become pregnant because now both tubes had been surgically removed. 2 years later, she comes in pregnant with a uterine pregnancy, And so the OB said this is impossible and went back to the pathologist who reviewed the specimens of the fallopian tubes that this same surgeon, this OBGYN doctor, had sent to the pathologist, and indeed they were both complete fallopian tubes that had been removed, tied off the remnants. There was no communication between the ovary and the uterus on either side of this woman's body, and she became pregnant. Now, that's not a near-death experience, but that is a miraculous life experience that I'm sure this essayist, the physician, was tempted to title her essay The Immaculate Conception, but we titled it The Impossible Pregnancy because, indeed, it was an impossible pregnancy, and we really don't know how. We do not know how she became pregnant.
Let's take some phone calls, either stories or questions for you. We'll start by going to Betty in Jacksonville, Florida. Hi, Betty. Go ahead.
Yes, hello, doctor. How nice to hear your voice. You sound very kind and very compassionate.
Thank you, Betty. That's nice.
I graduated from nursing school in 69, and I worked all those years, the last 11 years. I'm now 83. The last 11 years I spent in hospice. And one of the stories that I often think about was one of the Sundays I was working. It was an afternoon, very quiet on the unit. And I was going in to hang the IV pain medication for this patient. She had terrible, terrible pain. And so I walked in. As I was walking in the door, I heard her talking and laughing, and very unusual for her. She never had company. And I said, what's so funny? And she said, oh, didn't you just see the friend that I just had come in? She said that we were going to walk out of here together. Mm-hmm. And I said, really? I said, no, I'm sorry. I missed that. And the whole time she talked, she said, you know, I dreamed about sitting on my front porch and watching my grandchildren play, but I'm not going to be able to do that anymore. But I'm so grateful that I had this visit today. Wow. And she passed that night.
Wow.
And I can't tell you how many stories like this I have experienced. So,
Betty, that's a wonderful story. There's one almost identical to that. You are not
really?
Alone. In the book, yes. There is a story of an elderly woman who had a terminal disease and hung on, and one day her doctor walked into the room and heard this elderly woman talking to someone in the room, and the doctor thought she was hallucinating or dreaming, maybe she was asleep, and the doctor asked the woman, who were you talking to? And she said, my husband, you don't see him? And the doctor said, no, I don't. But well, it's, my husband was here, and he said that it was okay to die now. Before that, when he came to visit, he said, you've got to hang on, you've got to give them a chance, but he's now given me permission to die, and she went on, as your patient did, to die very shortly thereafter, having gotten permission from a visitor.
There's an angle of philanthropic endeavors in this book. Can you tell us about that?
Yes, the essayists, the physicians, my colleagues, all named a specific charity that they were committed to and would like to see the proceeds from the book go to. And we are donating 100% of author proceeds from sales of the book, from royalties and advances resulting from book sales. 100% of the net author proceeds are being donated to the 65 charities that our physician essayists named. A beautiful collection of
very admirable
of charities, and so there is nothing in it, as the expression goes, there's nothing in it for me or for any of the other essayists financially. There's tremendous value in it for all of us emotionally, spiritually, from a personal fulfillment point of view, but this is not a money maker for us. This is we hope, a big money maker for the 65 charities that the physicians are committed to.
When you put together the 85 essays, anyone shock you? Did anything shock you?
Well, I have to say that many of them shocked me. This was a story would come in. I and my wife is my my lifelong partner and my editor and my shock barometer, I would say, I would call her over and say, you will not believe this story. And it is a remarkable, I mean, there are remarkable stories. There's a story of a 60-year-old woman who had a sarcoma tumor growing in her groin. She went in for what was hoped to be a routine resection of this tumor. And the surgeons go in, and they found that when they tried to resect the tumor, it had grown into the femoral vein, a very large vein in the groin. And the bleeding was enormous. As they took the tumor away, it tore apart the vein. The entire abdominal and peritoneal cavities filled with blood. No one could see anything. And what was going to be a routine resection of this sarcoma tumor became a disaster in the making. And the experienced surgeons are digging into the woman to try and find the bleeder, to stop the bleeding. No one can find it. The blood pressure is dropping. The heart rate is going up. The woman is going into shock. And everything that they try fails, and there is a resident, a surgical resident who's in the room, whose job it usually is to, after a routine procedure, close up the skin incision for experience in suturing under the supervision of the experienced surgeon. The resident had no idea why this came to him, but he said, "Can I try?" And then he thought to himself, "Can I try? What am I saying? These are the top surgeons in the city, some of the top surgeons in the country, and who am I? I'm saying, can I try?" And they said, and the surgeon looked up in disbelief. The woman's filled with blood, and they cannot find the bleeder. And they said, "Sure, go ahead and try," sort of in disgust at this resident. They handed him the special forceps. It's called a vascular needle driver, where you're supposed to find the bleeder and pull the suture through it. And he plunges his hand into the sea of blood, which is the title of the essay, and finds something. He pulls the stitch through, and the bleeding stops. And he writes, "I don't know what motivated me to say what I said, to think that I could do anything, and I certainly know that it was not my hand that tied that stitch." And, you know, so you read a story like that and you think, oh my goodness. But there are so many of them. It's just, there's a 10-year-old little girl who was on a motorboat on a holiday weekend with her family, and the motorboat stopped abruptly, and she fell underneath the boat and got shredded, literally shredded by the propeller of the boat. Her liver was lacerated, her chest was lacerated, 8 ribs were cut, literally cut, split, with her lungs protruding from her chest. She went on to survive and have a completely normal recovery. So that story comes to me by email or by a phone interview, as some of these came to me with an interview with the physician on the phone. And I am just floored, stunned, floored.
I've got to tell you, these are some of the greatest stories I've ever heard, Doc. And I've heard many.
Thank you, George.
They're really intriguing. We go next to Walter in Pennsylvania on the wild card line. Hey, Walt, go ahead.
Hi, George.
Hey, Walter.
Well, from our past conversations, you know that I'm more or less a doubting Thomas regarding these questions of miracles and angels, et cetera. And with deference to the good doctor, I think he's ignoring the scientific fact that there is a thing called the placebo effect, and that the placebo effect is very real. I think the good doctor is ignoring the fact that just as there are what may be called psychosomatic diseases, there are also obviously what may be called psychosomatic or quote-unquote miraculous cures. So I think there is a scientific explanation for all of this.
Well, there might be, but I still think they're miracles.
Walter, I absolutely agree that there is certainly a placebo effect, and we see that in all of medicine. And I am personally a scientist. I have written 175 medical and scientific publications in the medical literature. where I describe clinical studies using placebo. We always are cognizant of the placebo effect. We're also cognizant of psychosomatic illness. But when an MRI shows a large tumor on the spine of a little boy who's being cared for in Atlanta, and and the MRI in Atlanta is sent with the little boy with this large tumor to California, where he's going to have, it's the West Coast, I don't think it was California, but to the West Coast, where he was going to have the definitive procedure in the prestigious children's hospital there. And the patient gets there after the three-hour flight from Atlanta to the West Coast, carrying the MRI that they just did. And they repeat the MRI, and the tumor is not there. And it has completely receded. It's very hard to explain that on the basis of placebo. We have a tumor that had been followed in this child for more than 2 years with consecutive MRIs that showed no change or slight enlargement of the tumor. Finally, the family decided they could not wait any longer and they needed to have it surgically removed. There was always the hope that this tumor might be one of the rare ones that would go away by itself. But it went away by itself on the plane ride from Atlanta to the West Coast. So it's very difficult. Of course, if there are people who have visions, who imagine, as is the case with Betty, with Betty's patient, someone in the room, and I use the word imagine not judgmentally. I believe there may have indeed been her friend in the room, as there was the husband in the room of the patient in our book. I believe that they may well have been in the room. But even if you question that, and I understand you're questioning it, and I understand you're being a doubting Thomas, but even if you question that, a tumor that disappears in a three-hour plane ride is very hard to question, or a patient who survives after an impossible resuscitation, or a mesothelioma lung tumor that resolves within a few days of visiting a monastery, and that tumor is an incurable tumor and it's gone. Well, I mean, those things may happen, and we know through the history of medicine that there are spontaneous cures. But when you're witness to that, I think it's reasonable to call it a miracle. It doesn't mean that there has been a divine intervention, although I personally believe that there is such a thing. But it certainly is appropriate, if you're the witness as the physician, to consider that a miraculous event.
And we're going to come back in a moment with final questions and stories. As we talk about miracles we have seen, stories that physicians have written in, they were compiled by Dr. Harley Rothbart, and he put them together, 85 cases of incredible stories. And whether it's science-related, luck, you can't dispute the fact that miraculous things did happen to people. On our next Coast to Coast program for the first couple of hours, one of O.J. Simpson's attorneys, Robert Shapiro, joins us to talk about his special foundation for his late son. We support that event, by the way. So he will join us for a couple hours, and we're going to talk about some strange things with Marshall Masters. And welcome back. Dr. Harley Rothbart with us. The book, Miracles, We Have Seen. Incredible stories. Now, did you have enough to do a second book with all the essays that came in?
Well, I have a number of residual essays that have come in primarily after the first batch, referred by some of the physicians who contributed. They referred their colleagues, or additional stories occurred to them. So I do have a budding file of additional essays. I have not actively solicited anymore because it's an enormous project, and I need to kind of regain my momentum and energy after all the effort to put this out. But it is certainly a possibility, because there has been an incredible interest in participating in future volumes, and I've got a list of people who have offered to send stories when and if we're able to do that.
Okay, let's go to the phones back again. Let's go to Old River, Texas. Brenda's with us on the wild card line. Hello, Brenda. Good morning.
Hello, George. Hello, Dr. Harley.
Hi, Brenda.
This is not really my real question, but on the lady with the topical pregnancies.
Mm-hmm. Topic.
It would be a topic. It would be strange if the little boy that was born, his name was Jeremy. I don't know if you even know the name of the boy.
I don't. I don't know. We protected the anonymity of all the patients. I don't know the name of the woman.
Why would you ask that? I'm curious.
Well, my cousin and his girlfriend were down here close to Baytown, and they she had a topical pregnancy, and my boyfriend noticed that she was plum white. Ambulance came, and they took, you know, that ovary out of the pregnancy in there, and then they moved up north, and the next thing, I don't know about a second one or not, but just the next thing I knew, she was actually pregnant, and the little boy's name was Jeremy.
Huh.
I don't know.
You never know. Synchronicities always occur, Harley, don't they?
They do, and in fact, there are synchronicities described in this book, not the particular one that you're describing, Brenda, but there are events in this book that could not possibly have aligned in any other way to result in the type of outcome that occurred. And we have to believe that there's some kind of a coordinated effort here for some of these extraordinary events. We haven't really talked about the serendipities and the synchronicities that comprise actually the first section of the book, but there are some really, really remarkable, you know, you could call them coincidences, but they are synchronicities and serendipities.
And I've always said there are no coincidences, Doc.
Yeah, I think you would be supported in that by the essays in this book.
Now back to some of these angelic interventions. Those fascinate me. You too?
Of course. I mean, we all have our images of heaven and of an afterlife and of departed loved ones. We all have our, I don't want to use the word fantasy because it may be reality, but we all certainly have our own feelings about those types of events. And there are enough of them that come through in the essays in this book that I, again, believe that these are not random, and they are not isolated, and they are not rare. So it is fascinating, and I think that the alignment of the stars that occurs, even if there isn't a vision or an image of an angelic being, some of the alignments are just unbelievable. There is a story of Father Carl, who was an overweight priest who was visiting his parishioners in the hospital, and a colleague of mine who is a cardiologist writes this essay, and the colleague was standing on the second floor of the hospital waiting at the elevator door for the elevator to go up to make rounds on this cardiologist patient. And the second floor is where the cardiac ICU is, and the second floor is where the cath lab is, where you do the kinds of studies to look at disease coronary arteries. The elevator door opens for the cardiologist to go upstairs, and out rolls a man in full priest's garb, apparently dead. And no one else is in the elevator. No one has any idea what happened. But at the feet of the cardiologist waiting for the elevator on the cardiac care unit, this priest rolls out with no heartbeat in fulminant cardiac arrest and on the verge of death. And a resuscitation occurred. There was incredible prayers being held, waiting room filled with nuns and priests from the community. The man recovered completely, and my colleague, the physician, the cardiologist who writes this essay, wrote that it was almost as if Father Carl had been delivered to my feet to be saved, because had this occurred anywhere else in the hospital, anywhere else in the city, anywhere else but at my feet in the elevator, this man would have lost his life because we were not, we were right next to the cardiac cath lab, right next to the intensive care unit. He could not have been delivered to a more opportune place.
Let's take a few more calls here. We'll go to Roger in Sherman Oaks, California. Hello, Roger. Go ahead.
Hello.
Hey, good to have you with us.
Yeah. Yeah, I wanted to tell about a friend of mine that used to go to lunch with me every, well, a couple times a week or every couple of weeks. And I hadn't heard from him for a little while, a week and a half. And so I called his home to ask where he was at. And his wife told me, oh, he's in the hospital. He's terminal.
Oh,
I said, well, what happened? And so she says, well, he had an aneurysm. And they cut open his head. They had a hole, about 3-inch diameter hole in his head. They pulled the bone out and looked in there, put it all back together and sewed him up and told him, you know, he's going to be put on life support. And he was on that for a day or two. And then he just, the two doctors got together and told the family, and told the family there at the hospital that he wasn't going to make it. And they wanted to pull the plug on him and disconnect all the life support. And so on the set, that was a Friday that I went over, that I found out about this, and I asked if I could go visit him. And they said, well, he's unconscious. And it was about 9 o'clock at night. I got over to the hospital and I talked my way into the care that he was in there. It was intensive care. And the nurse said, well, nobody's around. Go ahead. And so I stood there at his feet at the foot of the bed and I grabbed his foot and I says, hey, Jim, you, first I looked at him and he was looking pretty bad and grabbed his foot and I said, hey, Jim, you owe me lunch. You've got to get up out of here. So the next, that was Friday night, Saturday morning, they, his family and everybody was there and they unplugged him. Sunday morning, he woke up and told the nurse he was hungry and he wanted to go home. And
oh, my goodness.
That was about 10 or 12 years before he did pass away from something else.
And, oh, my goodness. Roger, that's
another miracle.
I didn't get my lunch.
I'll tell you, there are two essays in the book that parallel that. A little boy who wakes up after weeks and weeks of coma, and the first thing he says is, I'm hungry. The first thing he says, and this is in the book, the chapter is called The Lazarus Child because this child appeared to come back from death. But the one that's even more similar to yours is the story of, again, a little girl who was in coma from a horrible medication error and feared to be brain dead. And the resident doctor came in, and he grew up to be a very prominent infectious disease physician and wrote this essay. But at the time, he was a trainee, and he said, you know, we're always taught we have to talk to our patients. We have to treat them humanely, even though we know they're not listening to us. And this little girl was in coma, but he went in, and he listened to her, and he said, you know, I'm going to put the stethoscope on, and it's chilly, and I just wanted to warn you. And then the physician had heard a joke that day, and he said, well, you know, I'm going to. So he whispered the joke into her ear, and she smiled. And he couldn't believe that. So he came back the next day with the mother in the room and another joke. And again, she smiled. And this little girl woke up from her coma with a complete neurologic recovery because, or in concurrence with, a physician whispering a joke in her ear that she clearly responded to. So those stories, your story, Roger, is a story that's reiterated by physicians who witnessed or experienced the identical types of events that you did with your friend Jim.
Does this give you a different perspective as a doctor, Harley, about what is going on with life?
Absolutely. We are players in a play. There's a wonderful quote that I love, I'm not going to be able to quote it exactly, but there are two people sitting in a outdoor performance of an opera, and the big beams at night are lighting up the stage, and in the beams there are moths that are flying around, and one of the viewers of the opera turns to the other and says, you see the moths up there? They're completely unaware of the performance that's going on down here, yet they're in their own play. They're in their own performance. And their lives are completely oblivious to what we're witnessing in this opera on stage. And then he says, perhaps we are like moths also, and in fact unaware of the bigger picture that's going on around us, because we just can't see that dimension, that much as these moths could not appreciate the opera going on stage.
Next up, let's go to Joe, Long Island, New York. Hey, Joe, take it away.
Hi, Doctor. I had two questions on the monastery case. You know, you're citing a saint and, like, I guess mystical figures. And I just wonder what you think of Padre Pio as a 20th century figure and by location. And my second question would be, the guy that fell, was there an updraft from the 47 floors? And that would be considered preventive. I mean, he didn't really have an injury, apparently. So that would be like a preventive miracle.
Well, he had massive injuries. To answer your second question first, Joey, the man who fell from he was in the intensive care unit for weeks and weeks, and it was not clear that he was going to recover. He did ultimately, which, again, stunned everyone because no one had ever recovered from a fall of that height. But he did have massive injuries. And as far as whether there was an updraft, the essayist, who was a very prominent surgeon in New York, wrote that, you know, there could be lots of different theories about, you know, maybe some kind of a parasail effect from the platform that they were falling on. But none of the theories explains survival from a fall of that height. And he was on the platform with his brother, who perished instantly upon impact. So it's really remains an unexplainable event. And I'm afraid I'm not familiar with the subject of your first question. You asked me what the impact of Padre. Tell me, say that one more time.
Three priests that bi-located, for example, and supposedly saw parachuting. You know, people were parachuting from planes in World War II after being hit, and he supposedly visited them and helped them land, stuff like that. You know, yet he was alive at the time.
Yeah, interesting. I'm not familiar with those vignettes, but I don't doubt one of the previous callers said that they're a doubting Thomas. Whatever the opposite of that, of a doubting Thomas is, that's what I am. I am an undoubting Harley, because I believe these things happen. I'm not naive, and I don't see the world through rose-colored glasses. I've spent more than 30 years taking care of patients with dire illnesses, children. I'm a pediatric specialist, and I'm a realist. But when I see things and hear things that I can't explain, as is the case with 85 essays in this book, I do not doubt. I believe that those things occurred, and I trust the witnesses who write about them, because they are among the most esteemed physicians in the country.
Website, Harley, would you give it out for us?
You bet. It's my name, Harley Rotbart, HarleyRotbart.com. And there's lots of information there about this book, about other books, but the Miracles Project link at that website will explain how this project evolved and the charities that are benefiting as a result of it.
Super. Harley, thank you. Very fascinating stories. I really liked them. For Dan Galanti, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean Laudasur, Stephanie Smith, Chris Burrows, and George Knapp. I'm George Norrie, somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM. We'll see you on our next edition. Until then, be safe, everyone.